What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, International Women's Day. It was March 8th, and as part of Women's History Month here at Media Geek, we'll listen to some excerpts of a broadcast, a day-long 24-hour broadcast put together on the internet by AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters. And of course, then we'll catch up with some Media Geek headline news. Just stay tuned. March 8th was International Women's Day here during Women's History Month, and the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, known as AMARC, celebrated the day with a 24-hour internet radio broadcast focused on women's issues, women's history, and of course, produced by women. And that broadcast was picked up by community stations around the world. On today's program, we'll listen to some excerpts of this programming that was compiled and produced by Pacifica.
Welcome to Pacifica Radio's 2007 International Women's Day special. I'm Deepa Fernandez at WBAI in New York. In this program, producers from Pacifica's five sister stations and our many affiliates bring you women's voices from around the world. Stay tuned for independent news, inspiring interviews, some her story, and some spoken word. We bring you these voices in the spirit of the women of the popular Assembly of Oaxaca, known as APO in Spanish. The APO is a grassroots movement and alternative governing structure made up of a cross-section of citizens from this Mexican state. The movement gained momentum when the government launched a crackdown on thousands of striking public school teachers. Last summer, its members took over every major state building in the capital, demanding the resignation of Governor Ulises Ruiz, who they argue is authoritarian and corrupt. On August 1st, thousands of women affiliated with APO took over 9 state-run television and radio stations. APO member Ana explains why.
These offices, which have as their slogan the Channel of Oaxacans, were lying because it was the channel of the PRI-run government. The information wasn't true. They were lying. So this produced a frustration within the populace, as if they were even being made fun of, which is when we women decided to take over the station. It wasn't planned at first, but the general discontent is that people were already fed up. We decided in that moment to come here.
While the women of APO occupied the TV and radio stations, they broadcast independently produced videos and anti-government programming.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day.
We begin this year's special broadcast with a short Her Story on the origins of International Women's Day. The piece is read by Maya Orozco and Nina Serrano, written and edited by Malihe Razazan, and was submitted by Lisa Detmer of KPFA's Women magazine, tracing its roots from 1908 when 30,000 women marched to New York demanding the right to vote.
As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children, and we mother them again. Our lives shall not be sweated.
It was on March 8th, 1857,
when women workers first marched on the streets of New York City. The majority of the demonstrators were garment industry workers who protested against low wages, 12-hour working days, and the overall inhumane working conditions they labored under. The demonstration was attacked by police, and many women were injured and arrested.
But it was March 8, 1908, that signaled the first wave of massive militant actions by women workers when 30,000 women marched on the streets of Manhattan, demanding the right to vote and to end child labor.
On February 8, 1909, in accordance with a declaration by the Socialist Party of America, the first National Women's Day was observed across the United States.
In 1910, at the Second International Congress of the Socialist Party, German socialist Clara Zetkin proposed that March 8th be proclaimed International Women's Day to commemorate the U.S. demonstrations and honor working women all over the world.
On March 19, 1911, International Women's Day was marked for the first time in Austria, Denmark, Germany, and Switzerland, where more than 1 million women and men attended rallies. In addition to the right to vote and to hold public office, they demanded the right to work, to vocational training, and to an end to job discrimination.
Less than a week later, on March 25, 1911, a fire broke out in the sweatshop owned by the Triangle Company in New York. 145 female garment workers were killed. Unsafe conditions contributed to the high death toll. Many of the fire escapes were locked to prevent the women from slipping out, even for a moment's break. 8,000 workers marched through the streets to attend the victims' funerals.
A year later, in 1912, women were among the 20,000 textile workers to strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, with a rallying cry of, "Better to starve fighting than starve working." The women stayed out for nearly 3 months.
Their courage inspired the poem, "Bread and Roses," written by James Oppenheim in 1912. While attending the strike at the textile mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, he saw the banner that said, "Give us bread, but give us roses." Bread symbolizing economic justice, and the roses representing the quality of life.
As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead, go crying through our singing, their ancient call for bread. Small arms and love and beauty, their drudging spirits new. Yes, it is bread.
Feminist struggles in North America reach further back in time than you might expect. Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz is often considered the first feminist of the Americas for her defense of women's right to learn. She was renowned as the Barquet period's finest Latin American poet. KPFT's Angie Moreno brings us more about a woman whose accomplishments have been lost for many in the male-dominated pages of history.
Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz was born Juana Inés Ramírez de Asbaje on November 12, 1648, in San Miguel Napantla, near present-day Mexico City. By age 3, she learned to read. Sor Juana had such a thirst for knowledge that by the time she reached the age of 7, she begged her mother to dress her up in men's clothing and allow her to study at Mexico University. This was during a time when women weren't allowed to be educated. Shortly afterwards, she was sent to Mexico to live with her maternal aunt. While there, she learned Latin, enabling her to read philosophical and theological works. Considered something of a child prodigy, she was introduced to the vicereine, Doña Leonor Careto, Marquesa de Mancera, and she won the affections of the court. At age 16, she was appointed a lady-in-waiting. She would live at court for the next 4 years, where she held intellectual conversations and debates with theologians, philosophers, and other educated men. Lacking the desire to marry at the age of 20, which was expected of young women during this period, Sor Juana decided to further her knowledge by joining the convent of San Geronimo and became a nun in 1668. This allowed her more time to read and write. It was here that she developed her personal library and study, where she wrote poetry and plays and studied philosophy, natural science, and music. It was said that she had 4,000 books in her personal collection, the largest personal library in the Americas. This during a time when works of literature were restricted in the Spanish colonies. Scholars and theologians would travel far and wide to visit her in the convent, where she would hold philosophical and secular discussions in her parlor, metal bars separating her from her guests. In 1680, the new viceroy, Marqués de la Laguna, arrived in Mexico with his wife, María Luisa, Condesa de Paredes, and Sor Juana and the viceroy quickly became close friends. This is evident in the letters she wrote to the viceroy, addressing her as Lisa or Lisida. Some of the letters included love poems. Many feared they were too close, and it was during this time that envy and resentment surrounded Sor Juana, making it dangerous for her to be opinionated in a world where males dominated and religion was the voice of reason. She was safe while the viceregal couple remained in Mexico for the next 8 years. Upon their return to Spain, Sor Juana lost their protection. In 1690, she wrote a letter criticizing a famous sermon by a Jesuit priest, which was later published without her consent by Sor Filotea de la Cruz, a pseudonym adopted by her supposed friend, the Bishop of Puebla, Manuel Fernández de Santa Cruz. Accompanying the publication was a letter written by this Sor Filotea, admonishing her for being too worldly and not conducting herself as nuns were restricted to do. Upset by the attack on her character, she responded with La respuesta de la poetisa a la muy ilustre Sor Filotea de la Cruz, or The Response to the Most Illustrious Poetess Sor Filotea de la Cruz, dated March 1, 1691. This response is considered the first feminist manifesto and her only autobiographical work. In this manifesto, she passionately and rhetorically defended the rights of women to aspire intellectually in a male-dominated society. She criticized the very teachings of the church for using the Bible as a weapon, for intimidating and marginalizing women for their own agendas. Under great pressure from the church, Sor Juana was ultimately forced to abandon her studies and give up her writing, her collection of books, as well as her musical and scientific instruments. In a statement of self-humiliation, she reportedly wrote the words in her own blood, Yo la peor del mundo, or I the worst of all, and never wrote again. Years later, while caring for her six sisters stricken by a plague that infected the convent, Sor Juana contracted the disease and died on April 17, 1695, at the age of 46. Considered the 10th muse and the phoenix of Mexico during her time, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz is hailed for her diverse styles of writing, from plays to ballads to love sonnets to essays. Her work fascinates scholars and critics alike. She was an enigma both in life and in her work, and went to great lengths to defend the rights of women to be educated and have the freedom to write. For Pacifica Radio's International Women's Day special, I'm Angie Moreno with Nuestra Palabra, Latino Writers Having Their Say, at KPFT Houston.
And you are listening to Media Geek, where we are listening to some excerpts of programming heard on a International Women's Day day-long broadcast sponsored by AMARC, the World Association of Community Broadcasters, and put together by Pacifica. You can check out Media Geek online at www.mediageek.net, and you can get the radio show online at radio.mediageek.net in the Ogg Vorbis and the MP3 formats. You can also subscribe to the podcast there, mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them along to me, Paul, at mediageek.net. We now return to programs excerpted from the day-long March 8th broadcast for the International Women's Day.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's International Women's Day special,
The Women of Juarez. At the west tip of Texas, a line divides us from them. And they on the other side, they all look like me. Yet on my side, we sit passively nearby, while the other side allows a slow genocide. 500 missing women. Some claim more, some less. Some dismissed as runaways against parents' protest. Hundreds found dead. Hundreds still missing. The exact count is a mystery. And those disappearing daily, they all look like me. I am a dead ringer for an army of the dead. Mexico slaughtered sisters, all young, long dark hair, dark skin, petite, some say pretty. All young, all lost or dead, and they all look like me. Some foolishly hunt for one serial killer, when bus and cab drivers, even cops are under suspicion, and the ever-growing numbers reflect an entire society where young women are expendable. Young women like me. Mothers recognize raped and mutilated remains, daughters' clothes with mismatched bones, DNA that doesn't match. This shirt was my sister's, but those aren't her slacks. This skirt was my mother's, but that's not her hat. Dumped like trash, burnt to ash in the desert. That keeps its secrets. One body found dumped in the middle of the street, in a neighborhood not unlike mine, on my side of the line where I am alive, and my father reclines in his retired military easy chair bliss of Fort Bliss. Mom and Dad warned to be careful, but aren't overly concerned when my brothers and I cross the border from El Paso to Juarez for late-night cheap college drinkathons. As long as we stay on those touristy paths that may exploit, but do protect Americans and our American dreams, see, we are different. And even my parents don't seem to see. All those missing women, they all look like me. But I'm told we are different. Less Mexican, less poor, American, thus worth more different. Yet all I can see are all the eerie similarities. They all worked like I do. So many last seen going to or coming from work at U.S. corporate-owned maquiladora factories. But I'm told this isn't an American issue. And hey, I'm lucky here on the safe side. Safe, yet still not out of earshot of the distant cries of family searching ditches and roadsides bearing snapshot after snapshot of my brown eyes. Have you seen this girl? She is my sister. La has visto es mi niña, mi bebé, my wife, mi esposa. Have you seen this face? Esta cara? When you fit the profile of a predator's prey, you can't help but take the crimes personally. I am a symbol of those who survive, mouth open in defiance of their silence, spared by a line drawn in the sand between their grandparents and mine. And if that line had fallen someplace closer to home, someplace, say, between you and I, who would I be? What would my worth be then? And if silenced, who would speak for me?
Thanks to poet Amalia Ortiz and producer Liz Strait at WMNF in Florida for that piece.
On April 15, 1949, Pacifica Radio went on the air for the first time, introducing listener-sponsored community radio to America. Lorraine Hansberry was the first black playwright and the youngest of any color to win the New York Drama Critics Circle Award for her drama, A Raisin in the Sun, which opened on Broadway in 1959. The play had its origins in Hansberry's own childhood experiences in Chicago in the 1930s. In defiance of so-called restrictive covenants that confined blacks to the ghetto, her family moved into a hostile white neighborhood. In 1961, Lorraine Hansberry took part in a panel discussion on Pacifica station WBAI called The Negro in American Culture. Hansberry was asked if she felt any conflicts about being both a writer and a black American.
I was dealing with a young man who would have, I feel, been a compelling object of conflict as a young American of his class, of whatever racial background. With the exception of the incident at the end of the play, and with the exception, of course, of character depth, because Negro character is a reality. There is no such thing as saying that a Negro could be a white person if you just change the lines or something like this. This is a very arbitrary and superficial approach to, I think, Negro character. I started to write about this family as I knew them in the context of those realities which I remembered as being true for this particular given set of people, and at one point, it was just inevitable that a problem of some magnitude, which was racial, would intrude itself, because this is, as I said before, one of the realities of Negro life in America. But it was just as inevitable that for a large part of the play, that they would be excluded, because the duality of consciousness is so complete that it is perfectly true to say that Negroes do not sit around 24 hours a day thinking, I am a Negro. You know, they really don't. I don't. I don't think he does or anybody else. And at the other hand, if you say the reverse, that is almost true.
Lorraine Hansberry from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.
Welfare Queens is a multimedia cultural activism project of Poor Magazine. The collective of very poor, homeless and formerly homeless mothers creates art, radio, online and visual media, education and theatre with the goal of resisting and reclaiming the racist and classist mythologies about poverty and the criminalization of poor people and people of colour in the US. They do this by sharing their own stories of barely surviving, thriving and resisting on welfare and in welfare institutions. The Queen's latest endeavour is a two-hour play featuring the voices of six poor women of colour and their personal stories of resistance and survival.
Welfare Queens.
Las Reinas del Welfare.
Through the creation of a play, movie, publication, and education project of the same name, a group of mothers, daughters, sons, and fathers who have survived, struggled, and dealt with this ongoing oppression will tell their stories, enact their struggles, and realize their dreams of survival, thrival, and resistance.
You know it's hard out here for mom when you're trying to get this money for the rent. For the crookedness and fake money spent will make a whole lot of mamas want to mob. You know it's hard out here for a mom when you're trying to get this money for the rent. For the crookedness and fake money spent will make a whole lot of mamas want to mob.
A new mythology provided the ideological cannon fodder for the attack on the poor and people of color. That mythology equates growth in poverty to growth in an underclass which is primarily black, Latino, and female. This was the basis for the myth of the welfare queen.
When does survival become criminal? When do poor women, poor mothers become the other? And who determines who is deserving versus undeserving of aid?
It was another mundane, breezy San Francisco morning in 1970. A time that everything was done by the rules, straight out of the book. Walk like, talk like, imitate, and maybe you'll be accepted into the mainstream. It was the social welfare department. Oh yes, they come under many disguises. Human resources, aid to children protective services, AFDC, and now human resources. My husband had just passed, and we were like sitting ducks. They had us for lunch.
This poem is in honor of homeless mothers and poor mothers, low-wage mothers and no-wage mothers, three-job working mothers and incarcerated mothers, immigrant mothers and all the mothers. This poem is in honor of all those poor women and men, and yes, I said men, because don't sing me that song about gender again, who fight and struggle and steal and beg in every crevice and corner to keep their kids in a bed, who dress and feed with tired hands, who answer cries over and over again. This poem is in honor of all those poor women.
No woman.
That was Poor Magazine's Welfare Queens, Laurie Tiny, Juniberg, Dorma. You can hear more from Poor Magazine on KPFA's morning show. This segment was co-produced by Tiny and Seema Noor and edited by Seema Noor. For more information about Poor Magazine, visit www.poormagazine.org or call 415-863-6306.
And that was excerpts from the March 8th day of programming dedicated to International Women's Day, sponsored by AMARC, the World Association of Community Broadcasters, and much of that produced and compiled by Pacifica. For more information, you can go to march8.amarc.org. You are listening to Media Geek. Here's a few news headlines. the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against unlicensed San Francisco Liberation Radio's challenge of the FCC's seizure of the station's equipment in 2003 after 11 years of broadcasting. Liberation Radio was contesting the manner of the seizure, arguing that the law required a hearing beforehand. The three-judge panel wrote, quote, "Neither broadcasters nor listeners have a First Amendment right to engage in or listen to unlicensed broadcasts," end quote. The station is now considering asking for a review by the full appeals court panel in order to establish rights for anyone who might be facing government interference with communication. And internet radio stations are worrying that a change in the fees they pay might put them out of business. On March 2nd, the Copyright Royalty Board of the Library of Congress approved a change in the royalty rates that are paid to record companies by internet radio stations for playing music. Under current rules that have been in place since 2002, internet stations pay based upon a percentage of the station's revenue. Under the new rules, stations would pay based on a per-song, per-listener basis. The new rates charge eight hundredths of a cent per song per listener for 2006. The royalty board's ruling is retroactive to the beginning of 2006. 11 hundredths of a cent in 2007, 14 hundredths of a cent in 2008, 18 hundredths of a cent in 2009, and 19 hundredths of a cent in 2010. The new rates could mean increases in royalty payments of several 100% for internet broadcasters, especially those who broadcast more than one channel. Traditional terrestrial broadcasters do not pay these royalty fees because the record industry has traditionally looked at radio as a promotional medium. Satellite radio broadcasters do pay a royalty, but that rate is still only about a fifth of the new rates to be imposed on internet broadcasters. The fee changes also may pose a threat to non-commercial broadcasters. Under existing agreements, public and community stations pay an annual flat royalty fee of $500 per channel. If these new rates are imposed on non-commercial broadcasters, they could increase fees by over 10,000%. Not a minor change. The reason why non-commercial stations pay a lower rate is because they entered in negotiations led by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in order to find rates that were appropriate to stations that don't make a profit, but were also satisfactory to the recording industry. Here's hoping that a similar new rate can be established for non-commercial community broadcasters like home station here, WEFT, where Media Geek is produced. We're not yet on the internet, though. We've been planning to get on this year. Obviously, a great increase in rates could be very difficult. We hope that the CPB will intervene and non-commercial broadcasters can get together. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kasilov in Anchorage, Alaska, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate 969.org, and RadioDriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station, too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.